I'm Lee Rayburn, and if you have weather questions, we've got the weather guys with your answer today. Steve Ackerman joins us once again, former Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduation Education at UW-Madison, also Emeritus Professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and John Martin, Professor and former Chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And you are welcome to our conversation as well with your questions, observations, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have a picture you'd like to share, you can send it to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Steve and John, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be
great
here.
Great to be here, Lee.
Best time of the month.
Well, we're getting ready for fall, I am excited for it. We have had a summer that has been a little bit turbulent, but dare I say that August seemed rather tepid by comparison to what we had leading up to it.
When I think back to the summer, it was really April. We had a lot of nasty weather, and then July as well, although through the year we've had a lot of tornadoes. Most tornadoes so far, and the tornado season's not over yet. So
And I think you're right, though, Lee, that August was about the most benign of those warm months. I mean, it was dry, which is unfortunate, but not too hot. Today, exceptional.
Right.
Aside from that, a pretty mild month.
Yeah. Not what I would expect from an August. Sweaty heat and just getting through it and looking forward to fall. Not that I'm not looking forward to fall, but some of these temperatures, even in south central Wisconsin, have been fall-like through August.
The minimum temperatures, too, have been up, I think.
The last few days, I mean, the last week, we had some lows in the mid to low 50s around. That was great.
Cool nights in August. Right. Awesome. I'll take it.
It always happens, but it always comes back like it is today, into the first week of September.
So if you were to give us a preview of what to expect from fall, I'd imagine that we would have some warmer weather at some point before we make way for winter. I would imagine that... I don't know. With the drought-like conditions, are they expected to continue? What can we say about what to look forward to here?
I think we're still looking at, it's a big El Nino year, so El Nino is going to really be kicking in later fall, not so much in September.
I would guess that the best month of the year is September 15th, October 15th around here, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. The weather is great because you're on a steady decline of overnight lows. I don't really care about the daytime highs so much as the overnight lows, because the lower they get, the drier the air is. And you can get to 85 with a dew point of 45, and that's a nice fall day. When it's 85 today and a dew point of 75, that's miserable. Nobody wants that anymore. We've had enough of that. So I guess I would say we're probably going to have, by about the middle of September, we'll have a heat wave here this week, and it'll feel miserable. And maybe there'll even be another visitation sometime in September. But by the end of September into early October, you almost can't lose here. Really nice weather coming.
And then the trees turn, too, which is also gorgeous.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to fall.
Me too.
But, Steve, we talked about this a little bit last time when John was biking across Europe, I believe.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was great.
Great reason. But the El Nino, and I'm seeing like an El Nino like none other. Haven't seen an El Nino like this in 80 years. But the question becomes then, what does that mean for us here in Wisconsin?
What it means is that come the wintertime, John is not going to be happy.
I'm not going to be happy.
Because typically what it means is we don't get snowfall. And so it changes the patterns of the upper air patterns, and it gets warmer in the upper Midwest. And as a result, we just don't get the snowfall that we want.
Yeah, so it doesn't lock into that. That isn't a guarantee. Yeah. That's what I'm telling myself.
It's true, but
it is true. It's not a guarantee, but it's really, I would not bet any significant money on that not being the case. That's correct.
Yeah. So this El Nino is warmer water in the Pacific?
Equatorial Central Pacific. Yeah.
And it's like the warmest that we've seen in a long time or perhaps ever?
Well, it's forecast to be about as warm as we've ever seen, and that tends to create greater probability of deep thunderstorms at those latitude and longitudes, and they rev the jet up in the Central Pacific, and that changes, as Steve said, the circulation in predictable ways in the Northern Hemisphere.
In ways that would be drier for us?
Warmer.
Warm.
Not necessarily less total water.
So we
it just
could
won't
have
come
rain.
As snow. We could have a rainy, drippy winter.
Yeah, I don't like that any...
No, nobody does.
No.
I mean...
And if you do, you should live in, Louisiana.
Yeah. I mean, no way. That's
Nobody's
terrible.
Dreaming of a wet Christmas.
No, not here.
It's a white Christmas.
Yeah.
Okay, so that would be El Nino for us. Every time I think of El Nino, I think of Chris Farley from Saturday Night Live. It's sort of just ingrained in my head that he is, to me, the representative of El Nino forever after. But how does this, what's La Nina then, and how do these two things compare? Mm.
It's part of a cycle. Okay. So it's part of what we call the ENSO cycle, the El Nino Southern Oscillation. So it's something that was observed back in the 1800s or so.
Late 1800s, and then it really put into some sort of statistical sense in the early 20th century.
Yeah.
Gilbert Walker and people like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the La Nina is the opposite. So the same places that'll be warm surface temperatures in the ocean will be cooler than normal in a robust La Nina. And that changes the distribution of the thunderstorms that arise over the tropical ocean, and that changes the circulation in turn.
So are we always having either El Nino-like conditions or La Nina-like conditions? Is that just always something that's happening?
Sometimes it's just average. Yeah, sometimes it's just average. And in fact, it's the departures from the average that qualify as either warmer or colder than normal, and those are the events that we're talking about.
And you've both talked about climate change in the past on this show. Does that have any effect on El Nino or La Nina?
I think people are trying to figure that out. Okay. I can't, for the life of me, figure out how that would be immune to what's going on in the background. But exactly how the ENSO periodicity might be affected, or the intensity of individual extremes, either the warm or the cold ones, might be affected, is, I think, not 100% understood right now.
Because it's so tied to the ocean, too. The El Niño, La Niña is so tied to what's going on in the ocean. So,
what about in the Atlantic? Because you were in Europe, and I've seen some stories about how some Atlantic currents could be impacting European weather in ways that led to some real hot weather there this summer, and some questions about weather extremes in Europe as a result of Atlantic currents.
Yeah, the so-called Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. The surface manifestation of that is the Gulf Stream that runs along the east coast of North America and then heads up to the British Isles and Iceland and, you know, the North Sea. And then underneath that, deep in the ocean, is a return that comes from the north to the south. And the idea is that we're learning some real new things about it here in our own department. Actually, Professor Elizabeth Maroon and a graduate student, Rudra Thacker, are learning that cold air outbreaks over the Labrador Sea in the wintertime have a really important impact in keeping that generation, that circulation generated, the flywheel going in that circulation. So if the climate warms and some of those cold air outbreaks and or strong cyclones that are related to them start to dissipate, then you've got a whole substantial part of the pumping of that circulation that's disappearing. And there's, when was it, 10 years ago, people were talking about an overnight cessation of the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. Now it seems like the consensus is there's no way it's going to happen that fast. However,
that it would just shut down?
Right. Yeah. There was talk about it shutting down over a period of months. Nobody seems to really go for that anymore. Okay. It seems like it's more of a gradual shutdown. But we're trying now to isolate, and I like this better, trying to isolate what are the physical factors that might lead to the shutdown, regardless of how long it takes to really be enacted. And that's more interesting to me as a scientist than trying to predict how quickly it might occur.
That's
fascinating, I think, that those cold air outbreaks are helping to drive that oceanic circulation.
I've been talking to oceanographers for years. I'm saying, I just couldn't believe it. I would talk to them once in a while casually, because I'm ignorant of really the ocean circulation. I don't know much about it. But I said to a number of my colleagues over the years, how can it not matter that this absolutely frigid cold air comes out over that relatively shallow part of the ocean, cools the surface water and makes it sink to the bottom, and that's got to be part of the flywheel. Oh, no, it's not that. It's other things. I'm like, you sure? No. Turns out maybe it is part of it.
You do know something about it.
Well, no, I mean, it's easy to have a crackpot idea, but it's not so easy to go and research whether or not it's true. You got to have expertise, which I don't have.
What's the effect on European climates if that slows or stutters or there is some sort of change?
Yeah, anybody who's ever been to London, Dublin, even places on the Norwegian coast, people have palm trees in the front of their homes. I mean, what is that? It's at 56 degrees north. I was just in southern Sweden, 57 degrees north, and people have palm trees in front of their homes. That is a function of the Gulf Stream, a robust Gulf Stream. Keeps it warmer there than it has any right to do. There's no snow at all in Copenhagen in the wintertime. People just don't even talk about snow there, and yet they're at that high latitude in Denmark. It's a function of the Gulf Stream. If that thing were to shut down, I think there could be substantial changes in some of those places. It would be colder by a long shot, including London, Copenhagen, The Netherlands, all of them.
Palm trees gone.
Palm trees. Yeah, they'd be a thing of the past.
Bretton Stoughton called, couldn't stay with us. He was looking at the USDA's plant hardiness zone map, and he noticed something interesting. Washington Island is zone 6A, but the rest of Door County is zone 5B. Any idea of why that is?
The first thing that comes to my mind is Washington Island. It's probably surrounded by water, and that probably modifies what happens in the spring and the summer.
That's
and
exactly
the winter, because it's probably all freezing. Well, no, it doesn't
quite freeze.
Or maybe
more snow.
Yeah, more snow.
Could be more snow.
But Door County's almost surrounded by water. Why wouldn't that be similar?
The fetch across Green Bay is probably not as great as the fetch from any wind direction around the island. When you're at the tip of the peninsula, that's probably a big difference. But I think the bigger thing probably is exactly what Steve said. Probably it takes longer in the spring to warm up on Washington Island than it does in most places on the peninsula.
That makes a lot of sense.
Just because of a lot of water.
Yeah.
Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our guests, the Weather Guys, and you are welcome to our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org. I suppose the big weather story, here's an email from Jane about El Nino. We've all heard Wisconsin will have a warmer winter, but the effects to other areas of the U.S. and African continent could be devastating, Gene says. It may be an inconvenience here, but could you talk about what the extreme El Nino means elsewhere? Otherwise, it sounds pretty ho-hum.
It can mean really bad things in our parts of our own country. So, we're kind of making a little bit light of the fact that what is likely to happen here is we'll get less snow and a little bit more rain events.
We're insulated here to some degree.
It has a pretty... a pretty consistently statistically verified impact in the way we're describing it. So it's a pretty strong signal here. It's pretty strong in Southern California, but it's not good there. It rains heavily down there. And then it rains in the Florida Panhandle, right? Far southeast. Is a lot wetter. So there's places where they were already at sea level. So you get a heavy rain there and you've got flooding problems. So there's a lot of places, even in the United States, that do not, celebrate a visitation by El Nino. So we have a little bit of a moderation of our regular winter conditions when we get one.
Coastal California flooding, Florida
especially
Panhandle.
Southern California,
flooding. Yep. And Southern California can't handle a lot of water.
No,
they
can't.
Built for that.
And they've got orography that makes any unusual rain event get worse. And so mudslides, landslides, it's bad, very bad.
Jane also brings up the African continent. Is there any... What does El Nino out in the Pacific mean to...
I don't know about that.
I'm not sure what happens in the Africa.
That's a good question. Yeah. I don't know.
But it would have a worldwide impact? I mean, does the El Nino have a global weather phenomenon then?
Yeah, and there's certain places that get a really robust response to it, and others get a little bit more of a watered-down one. But it is a global-scale phenomenon. Absolutely right.
So I imagine by now you've seen some of the videos from Nepal and raging floods there is just almost unfathomable. It looks like a disaster movie or something.
Yeah.
And I saw from the New York Times over the weekend, I see from NPR today that this appears to be related to glacial melting, which I don't know that people might have considered in the past.
I think people considered it in the past, but now it hits a reality of how that could happen. Mm-hmm. So, usually when I think of glacial melting as an example, I think of it as a slow process.
Going into the ocean, sea level slowly rising. Yeah.
And then in this case, at least from the stuff that I've looked at and read, is it slowly melts and then, if it's hanging off, it breaks and comes down and falls.
Yep.
And once that falls... You're going downhill, whether it's ice or water flowing downhill is generally...
Or an avalanche, too, because there was sediment that fell through.
It hits melt ponds that are filled to the brim, and there's this giant volume of frozen water that gets in there, and it spills over the edge, and places downstream are not ready for that.
It's like if you have your cocktail filled to the rim and then decide to throw four ice cubes
in. It's going to spill over. And, and your point, too, Lee, and Steve echoes it, people have been tracing their reduction, recession, they call it, of glaciers for a long, long time. And we've seen, famous pictures of sort of Glacier National Park 50 years ago compared to today. Yeah. One of our colleagues, now deceased, bless his soul, Stefan Hastenrath, was a tropical climatologist, and he studied the glaciers in the Andes. and you see these things recede as best you can measure it, and there's no question what's doing it. It's a change in the climate, because the length of the summertime and the number of sunny days and all the rest of that stuff is not different today than it was 100 years ago down there. It's the atmospheric composition that's changing the amount of radiation that's incident on those glaciers. And the consequence of more radiation is they melt away. And this is what's happening.
Yeah. But then forecasting it must be crazy in terms of those extreme events.
Right, right.
You know, what makes that drop? I mean,
prediction models would not be able to.
Prediction models, right.
Because it's a catastrophe.
It's a catastrophe.
Stefan used to use that word, too, when we would talk all the time about the lake cooling down in the fall. Yeah. And I would say to him, you know, we're really close. The whole water column would have the same temperature. And he'd say, yes, maybe next week is the catastrophe. And I'd say, what do you mean? Oh, when the ice covers the top. And that's what it is. Because it's a phase change all of a sudden. Snap your fingers, phase change. And anybody who's been on ice that gives way, if you kind of been skating for 3 or 4 days in a row in early February, and then you go out one day and you put your foot through it, that's a catastrophe. And watching a giant piece of ice fall off of a glacier is a catastrophe in the same way. Yep. Yeah.
Could something like what took place in Nepal happen anywhere in the United States that you could see, where a glacial recession could lead to instant flooding like that?
I don't know.
I'm not sure either, but I would, if I were to explore this more, I would look at some of the mountain areas up in Alaska.
Yeah, yeah.
And see
Mount Rainier is one of
there.
The places that has shown some recession of glaciers.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
I wondered, and it might not be that populated around where that could fall, but there are some expectations that the glacier is going to continue to melt. What that means is still probably impossible to predict.
Yeah, and it might be the surrounding topography. This might be what you're thinking. You know, if you have surrounding topography that's just below the melt line, you might have melt ponds that are sitting there waiting for a piece of ice to come in and cause a problem. Mount Rainier is not surrounded by such things, and it has the Kent Valley to its north, but that's a result of an eruption about 500 years ago, and it's an extremely fertile area. Yeah. If there's another eruption or an ice melt, the Kent Valley is going to be flooded, that's for sure. Yeah.
All right.
There's a lot of people live there.
Yeah. So that it could happen here then. That is something.
Yeah.
That,
maybe not exactly in the same way, but sure, it could.
Patty emailed us, have we had significantly more dew points in the 70s and 80 degree range in the past few years? And if so, why would that be?
Yes. And I can tell you, I have an undergrad student who's going to be a senior this year from Milwaukee. His grandmother was asking him the same question. It got him curious. We've been working on this problem for about 6 months now. It's undeniable that in the central United States, we have had an increase in the aerial extent of air that contains high temperature and dew point simultaneously over the last 78 years or so. Unquestionably true. And the other thing is, we live in the only part of the world, poleward of 40 degrees north, 40 degrees north or south, I should have said poleward of 40 degrees, that regularly has excursions of air that's as deeply tropical as the air that we're talking about right here. Yep, it's the only place in the world that does that. Gulf of Mexico is close by.
Okay.
The Rockies are to our west.
Huh.
So anytime there's a strong southerly flow in the lowest part of the atmosphere, the Rockies prohibit it from finding its way west, so it comes straight northward. In addition, agriculture. So
corn sweat.
Corn sweat.
A lot of
wow. So if you grow acres and acres of corn, which is a plant that has almost no skill at all at managing water, you are going to increase the dew points. Yep, that's it.
So are you saying there's no such thing as soy sweat?
I don't know about that. That's a good question. Somebody knows. I don't know the answer, but I bet you it's less.
Wheat always seems pretty dry.
Yeah,
so
wheat is dry as
a bone. I don't worry about wheat, but
corn is very bad at managing water. All the grasses are pretty bad. Yep.
So this is a product of our geography, but also our agricultural economy.
It's a combination. So this is a rich little research vein that Eddie's going to have to really work on.
And also, the temperatures are going up.
Yeah.
Yes,
which means that there's going to be more water in the atmosphere.
More transpiration,
and the dew point goes
exactly
up.
Right. Yeah. They're going to go hand in hand.
So our heat's increasing, but what I've seen is that it's kind of our night temperatures, at least, that are increasing more so than our daytime temperatures.
Yeah, daytime highs are a little more stubbornly resistant to going to new records. But overnight lows, that's the worst part of the day when you think about it. If you can't cool down, you start out the next day warmer than you've ever had on such a day, and you're going to get a miserable, long, humid day. Yeah. So
that makes a lot of sense to me. And is that trend expected to continue? Is there some stability that can be found? Or is this part of the global climate change that as long as we don't change anything, that we can expect these dew points to continue to increase?
Yeah, business as usual means it gets worse. Yeah. No question in my mind.
Business as usual does not sound like business as usual. That sounds like that means increased adaptation and extremes.
That's what we ought to be shooting for. Yeah. But I'm talking about the business as usual as mandated by you know who.
So if we don't change, then the dew points will continue to change.
Yes, they will. If we don't change, they will change.
That's nature for you, isn't it?
Yeah.
One way or another.
Trying to teach us.
Just going to compensate. So, but it's not like we can get rid of our corn. We kind of need our corn. That part seems to be pretty necessary. We're going to have to stay corn sweaty. So what are some of the other solutions that would be viable?
Reduce the carbon dioxide fraction. Just keep on hammering that simple point. Figure out other ways to energize our economy.
It is that simple?
Well, I'm not saying that simple, but if you can do that, you'll see a reduction in the high, in the average temperature, which will then bring a reduction in the dew point, which will make people stop complaining about the heat and humidity to some extent.
Reduce carbon monoxide.
Carbon dioxide,
yeah. CO2.
Yep.
Yeah.
In the atmosphere.
Yep.
And that would be combustible engines.
Yeah. Right.
What else would we be looking to knock off there?
Anything that uses a petroleum-based fuel, yeah.
So you're going to...
And that's a long-term change, even if you were to...
Well, but this isn't anything new that I've heard.
Right.
Like, this is recent, and yet it's business as usual, although we've known what that simple solution would be, and it just makes it more complex as our dew points continue to rise.
Yeah, and it makes it more difficult to change because we're in this situation.
Someday, people who are relatives of us are going to look back and say, what the hell were they doing? Why didn't they do it? They knew the answer. Why didn't they do anything about it? It's a question we cannot answer today, and they will certainly not be able to answer 100 years from now. But that is the challenge.
How interesting that it's not... We can't explain why we don't do anything that we know we have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we see the changes.
It's changed human nature, too, then.
Right.
We now get wrapped up in, we've learned to drive around with cars. Or you can get EVs,
right,
and things like that that could support it.
Is it human nature or is it economic policy?
It's probably a combination, right?
It's a combination. If
our economic policies change to force you to change, which things have happened in the past that have done that, then we will change.
Well, I think of the chlorofluorocarbons in the atmosphere
when we had
the hole in the ozone layer, and now we don't have the hole in the ozone layer, and people say it was a hoax, but at the same time, there was a worldwide effort to close
to stop
that.
It, right.
Yeah. Well,
I know people must say it's a hoax, but these people are idiots. Okay, let's just say it. They're idiots.
Because this was a worldwide effort to close the ozone hole, and by and large, it was a success because it was a worldwide effort.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
So you can't say it can't be done because
we've
done it.
Yeah. We have done it.
And if we see things like what took place in Nepal as an event, and Grand Canyon, which we can get to in a moment because I've got questions about connections with that, that if we see these things happening, then we're compelled to act.
You'd think.
Yeah.
I don't have an answer for that.
You'd think.
All right. And if we don't today, how will they in the generations to come? Our guests, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, the weather guys, are here to answer your questions. Dean, I can get to you in just a couple minutes if you can hang on. Thank you. Steve is the former vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison, emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin, professor and former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And you are welcome to join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News.
The weather, Wisconsin, the climate, the world, our guests, the weather guys. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're joined by Steve Ackerman and John Martin, who are here to answer your weather, atmosphere, climate questions from our backyard to around the globe at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Dean in Lake Superior. Dean, thanks for hanging on.
Hi, folks. Yeah, we're up on Lake Superior here, visiting from Colorado with our sailboat. Just a quick follow-up from the previous discussion. The acid rain was another issue, or acid precipitation. Mm-hmm. And we had a relatively quick solution for that, like the ozone hole. But I think economies of interest are a lot bigger this time regarding fossil fuels, and there's a lot of power and influence to push back to what we depended on in the past as far as that concern. I have a point of trivia for you guys, by the way, before I get to my question. We're traveling to the farthest north tip of Wisconsin, and my question is, where am I going?
To the farthest northern tip of Wisconsin.
Schoolhouse Beach.
Sorry?
Schoolhouse Beach on Washington Island.
Yes.
All right. Good job, John.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Did you have a question, Dean?
Yes, and that's Devil's Island, by the way, on the Apostles. And so, yes, I do. So, we're on Lake Superior, and I was wondering if what you guys might know in terms of updates on the fate of the precipitation versus evaporation question for Lake Superior. Will it, through the decades, be dropping due to greater evaporation, or will it maintain somehow a balance with enough precipitation?
Seems to fluctuate.
I don't know what the long-term answer is.
Yeah, we've been on our show a long time, and so this has been a good question that's come up a number of times. It was a period of time when we were having relatively warm winters when the lakes were losing water.
Right.
And it didn't occur to us, and I don't think it was in the literature anywhere either, that the ice coverage was a major factor in that, because the watershed around the Great Lakes is exceptionally small. It's almost the same as the footprint of the lakes themselves. In other words, rain that falls on the ground within, I'm going to make up too small a number, 20 miles of the shore of Lake Superior,
doesn't get there.
Yeah. It flows somewhere else. Yeah. So, but it's not quite just 20 miles, but it's pretty small. So when the lake's covered with ice in the wintertime, that puts a halt to evaporation. And that usually means the lake level's pretty good for the next year. If it doesn't, then there's too much evaporation and the lake level never really recovers, no matter what the subsequent year brings in terms of precipitation, unless it's excessively over average, which doesn't usually happen. Yeah. So I don't know what the long-term prediction is. That's a good question, but it would probably, a factor would be the ice cover. And so given the fact that the planet's warming up, I'd guess that that's always going to work against a lake level staying high.
Yeah, and you'd need a lot of precip to make it up. Yeah.
Great question, Dean, and trivia question. So thank you for the call. Let's go to Dave in Oregon next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you doing? I love the Weather Guys commentary, and I read their articles in the State Journal, so thank you. My question has to do with the rising humidity levels, the dew points, and how much the corn, because of agricultural practices, et cetera, is contributing to that. And my question is, we as a people spend a lot of money subsidizing the ethanol industry in the United States, which is based from corn. And if we didn't have ethanol that we were using, we would have a lot less corn acreage. And I wonder if you think that would impact dew points and humidity levels.
Well, I think that's a really interesting question.
Yeah,
it also shows the circulation of the problem, right?
Yeah.
Because we're doing ethanol because we don't want to burn carbon dioxide.
Right.
If you're going to have less corn to support ethanol production, then how are we going to make up for that?
And is it true that ethanol burns more cleanly than regular gasoline?
I think
gasoline?
It does, yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that, but I assumed it was probably true.
Yeah,
it's a very good question. I think... And Lee had a question about soybeans. I don't know what the answer is for soybeans, how well they manage water. But corn is, I think it's a what is it called, a C4 grass or something, and it's very, very bad at managing water. You have to water it, and it evapotranspirates almost immediately what you gave it. So it might be among the worst. Anything else that would supplant it acreage-wise, most likely, I'm not an expert, would be better at that management than corn is. And so that would reduce the dew points, for sure, no question. And the humidity levels would be a little more tolerable. They'd probably still remain intolerable, and they'd be a little bit more tolerable.
In the summer. Yeah.
So we could get rid of ethanol, and that might increase our CO2 emissions from fossil fuels.
Right. So
but
you'd have
then
the
we would have less humidity from ethanol, though we might have more from carbon dioxide.
Yeah, and you'd increase the temperature, as Steve says. The feedback from the CO2 would be worsened, and so, you know, you'd have an increase in the humidity just from that.
Yes. And I also wonder, I mean, some of the corn around here is also cattle corn, right?
You feed cattle. Yeah. So, right. That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how much goes to ethanol or where it comes from, but I also know it comes up in presidential primaries every time it hits the Iowa caucuses.
Yeah, that's right.
So
that's right.
Is part of the policy, and it is part of the politics.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It makes it a good question, Dave, and thank you for asking. I saw one of your recent columns, the Weather Guys columns, about actually it mentioned radio, atmospheric ducting.
Mm. Yeah, that was a really interesting case that came up. So we've known about ducting of sound waves. And you've probably, if you're as old as us and you've driven with your AM radio at night, you know, all of a sudden you can get radio signals from states that you normally don't even travel to.
That's right.
And part of that is the thermal structure of the atmosphere. That is, waves, sound waves, they travel as a function of this. Their speed is a function of the air temperatures. And so you can get these ducting where waves that would be normally going out to space hit a region in the atmosphere that may have an inversion, and it bends it back down towards Earth. And so what I came across reading some article was there was a fire alarm in Iowa. and they sent off this signal, and they hit a upper-level inversion that changed the direction of the sound wave, and it went and it hit Indiana or Illinois, I think it was.
Oh.
Or, Indiana. So, you know, several states away.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And it happened to be the same electrical signal, the same frequency that set off
a fire alarm.
Oh, wow. So, unbelievable.
So all of a sudden, all these alarms began to go off. And, tornado. I think it was a tornado, actually, maybe. And, you know, people are going, what the hell's going on?
It was
at night, and it's, you know, beautiful. It's like, why are these things going off?
You know, that kind of, there's a background story there. We'd only have a small pot of electromagnetic spectrum available for sale.
Right, yeah.
For
some
of these, you know, signals and stuff, and it gets crowded.
Right,
so.
And you think, all right, so let's let, you know, Indiana have this one and Iowa have this one.
Yeah, because they're not going to talk. Right, that'll never be a problem.
I think of it from the AM radio band, because we used to get listeners, and maybe we still do, but from all the way in Europe, or some overnights with a strong signal and the weather's right, and they would write and say, I heard you, and they'd quote exactly what they heard, and then they'd ask you to send you a t-shirt. Could you send us a t-shirt? I mean, it was like sport for some of them to listen for. And I guess atmospheric ducting would probably explain how it got all the way overseas and ended up somewhere in Europe.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Yeah.
That's fascinating. Let's
go get local examples of that. I used to tell my kids this all the time. You take the bus to work, and after a fresh snowfall, the next morning, the temperature is going to be pretty cold, and there'll be a deep inversion. Temperature increases with height away from the snow at the surface. I could hear the bus coming way before on those days than on any other day, because the sound waves would get trapped in the inversion. And you can actually hear it, even though they get muffled by the snow.
No.
The trapping is so intense, you can tell the bus is coming.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's really neat.
It's an audio illusion?
It's not even an illusion. It's a real physical fact. Those waves are not getting, they're not propagating up. They're not getting through the inversion.
They're just
bouncing right back down. Yeah.
It's a weather geek waiting for the bus.
Yeah. You know, if it's freezing cold, you got to do something to keep yourself excited.
Let's go to Barry in Manitowoc next. Barry, hi. Bernie, I'm sorry. I saw that wrong. Bernie, hello.
Bernie in Manitowoc.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I hope I can just spew all this out. ethanol is really just a make-work project, and it makes all us environmentalists feel good. But number one, it is highly questionable whether or not it produces any net energy, and there have been PBS documentaries to this effect. You can consider all the diesel fuel that goes into it, all the natural gas for drying, ammonium fertilizers, which are produced from natural gas, the hauling, the blending, all that. Beyond that, there used to be a professor at the University of Wisconsin who went out on these tours to the counties and told us farmers that growing corn in Wisconsin was a really bad idea, and he heavily promoted alfalfa instead of the corn because it didn't require the ammonium fertilizers, it didn't require the pesticides, and it made a lot of sense for dairy cattle because it was higher protein. And that has all gone by the wayside for a lot of reasons, one of which is because you don't spread manure on alfalfa. It's a great place to get rid of the manure on the fields when the field is open all the time. So if you're not getting any net energy out of it, and you're producing these other environmental effects, I strongly suggest that all the bulletins and things that Dr. Howard put out, Dr. Terry Howard, are probably still in the UW library somewhere, and I strongly suggest pulling them out and take a look at them. We actually used to have an organization called the Wisconsin Forage Council, if it wasn't the National Forage Council. I got rid of all my books long ago, but they had, pictures of alfalfa growing. The trend towards corn in Wisconsin, row crops in general, has been extraordinarily destructive, not economically feasible except for the subsidies, and now we're hearing about the corn sweat and increasing the dew points. This makes no sense if you've been in agriculture long enough to have seen the changes, and I have.
Makes no sense agriculturally, but somehow it makes sense politically still.
Well, yeah, it makes sense politically, but I think Barry's bringing up an interesting point of, again, the whole in changing just one thing isn't necessarily the answer. You have to look at the whole cycle of what's
system.
Going on, and that's what makes it complicated.
Yeah, it's a very complicated problem, right?
Yeah.
Bernie, it's a great call, and I thank you very much. And I've written down Dr. Howard's name in the Wisconsin Forage Council, and there's probably a deeper discussion to be had here about what we grow and why and what that means for our agriculture economy and our environment, and it's all interconnected.
Yeah.
But then again, so is the politics, and that seems to play a central role.
Right. That's what we're learning.
Heather in Appleton emailed us with the F3 tornado that moved through the Fox Valley in July. There was some very intense lightning that was very bright and sounded more like a bomb going off, but very little thunder, unlike normal lightning. Normal's in air quotes there. Is there a name for this type of lightning, or were they just right there at the sight of the lightning and that's why it felt like a bomb going off?
That's probably it.
Yeah, that's probably really close to it.
Yeah.
Because normally you see the lightning and then it's 1,000, 2, 1,000, 3,
right.
until you hear the thunder, and that's how far you know the lightning is away from you. But if it's right under
it's
on,
right on
top of you, it is an instantaneous
you're
boom.
You're not going to get to one.
That's right. You're barely taking in breath and you're hearing the explosion. Yeah.
Which goes to how extreme that storm was and how it was centrally
how close
located.
She was.
Yeah, close she was. Yeah,
right
yeah.
underneath her at that moment.
Even an ordinary thunderstorm without tornadoes, if you're right underneath it, might give you that impression. Yeah,
I can understand that. And that was an awful event, but it feels like we haven't had that extreme weather, at least from what I've seen, largely since those Fox Valley tornadoes.
Yeah.
There may have been some heavy rains, but nothing that, threatened lives like that.
Yeah, well, it's been a second most tornado season so far.
And, but that happened so early on in the season,
well,
right?
Well, that's true. Yeah, that was back in, a lot of it was in April.
It felt like it happened all, and if it continued the way it was, we were on our way to number one with a bang, but...
Yeah, but now we got a long way to go still. 20, I think. We're 40-something, and the record is 60, I think.
Yeah, wow. We got a chance.
When was the record set, do we know offhand?
I don't know that offhand.
Like 2009, I think.
Oh, not that long ago.
Not that long ago, yeah.
All right. That's Steve Ackerman, former Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Also joining us, John Martin, Professor and former Chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. They're our weather guys, and you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk at WPR.org. Let's take a moment to talk about the flash flooding that occurred in around the Grand Canyon over the weekend. People were evacuated. People are still missing. There appear to be as many as three dead so far in the latest news that I've seen. But the question I have about this has to do with the connection between forest fires and flash flooding, because it seems, as the Arizona Republic points out today, the Dragon Bravo fire, federal scientists warned after that it could create increased runoff as a result of rains, that the loss of forestry could create the environment for some flash flooding. Is there a connection there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, once you have a forest fire that's so destructive, once it rains, there's nothing to try and hold that water down, so it's just going to flow downhill more quickly and more completely than if there was vegetation there.
Absolutely. And what's that testifying to at the same time is that it's not really an unusual rainfall event. It's just that it's falling on an unusually denuded landscape, and the consequence is deadly in this high topography regions.
So, okay, high topography regions. That helps to answer my next question, I think, when we look at the forest fires that have become annual events in Canada that we've faced the repercussions from seemingly in an annual way here in Wisconsin.
Ontario, yeah.
Does that lead towards the potential for more flash flooding in those areas?
You still need the
topography?
The topography that goes with it. So, yeah, if you have, you know, we burn a lot of fields here in Wisconsin, whether they're corn or just for prairies. And when it rains, we don't get flash flooding.
Right.
It just then absorbs into the soil. It has time to settle in.
The Western Canada, though, has vegetated mountains in the, you know, in Saskatchewan and Manitoba, and so especially Saskatchewan. And they can have, and Alberta province, they can have flash floods in those regions for the same reason, although that doesn't seem to happen so often. It's harder to get the really intense thunderstorms that far north, so that's part of it. There's not as much moisture in them. But when you're down over the United States Rockies, especially the Southern Rockies, that's not as hot a challenge to meet.
Yeah. All right, that makes me feel a little bit better, because that's another like instant tragedy that unfolds that seems to be connected to other weather events, and it's not just the rainfall, it's also the forest fires. Right. And again, these things all seem to be interconnected in a way that help explain why they happen at the very least, and not if they don't help force us to ask the question how they can be prevented. And that's another question that probably deserves to be answered. I saw a video online the other day of what appeared to be lightning striking an airplane, and it made me scared. Do lightning strike airplanes, and if so, do they have an effect? Do we know? Do either of you have an answer for that?
They hit airplanes quite frequently.
Quite frequently,
But the planes are designed to deal with it, and you're not going to get quite the strikes, I think, that we heard the previous caller about.
Right, on the ground.
Like an explosion, because in most cases, well, in all cases, the airliners are going to try and avoid convection and where the lightning is. But nonetheless, they still get hit.
Yeah. So they would fly around it if they could.
Major convection, if they can fly around it, they're going to.
I don't know if a plane's ever been brought down by lightning, actually.
I don't think so.
Maybe the one that went from Sao Paulo to on the way to Paris a few summers ago that disappeared over the southern Atlantic might have been a victim of that. They don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think they know what brought that down, but it's rare that it's that danger.
It does happen, and when it does, airplanes have planned for this, and because it's so high in the atmosphere, it's not likely to have the same sort of, I don't know, fiery impact that it would on the ground?
Well, you could still get strong lightning higher in the atmosphere. What I was trying to point out is that they're not going to go towards the core of where those lightning
to the heaviest lightning.
But nonetheless, you know, you could look on a thunderstorm, even around here, you know, on the anvil part, it may look very calm and related, but lightning does come out of the side of the storms and then down. So if you're in the vicinity, you know, there's a good chance to get hit, and then they do get hit.
How does lightning make that decision? I mean, it sounds like airplane's kind of a lightning rod. It's a big metal stick up in the middle of the air, so you'd probably see an electrical current easily connect to that. It's looking for something like that,
right? I mean, there's a charge building up in the atmosphere, and the lightning, and particularly lightning and thunderstorms, you know, you get in the separation of charges in the storm. And so the lightning's trying to equal that out. That's why they happen. It's just get too imbalanced.
So lightning is a balancing act by Mother Nature?
In fact, Mother Nature is almost always balancing.
Yes, that's right.
What she does.
It doesn't take very much imbalance for her to fall over and crush us.
Wonderful way to explain weather. It's just Mother Nature balancing out. Although it seems extreme, like lightning.
Well, that's because we got out of balance.
That's right. That's right.
It's not Mother Nature out of balance.
It's us.
And one way or another, she's going to find that balance. It's if the thunder or lightning or flooding or whatever it takes to find that balance, it's going to get there. And it's always stronger than we are for some reason.
Yes. Most mothers are.
I appreciate it. So how does the lightning decide which path to take? Why does it come out sideways and go down? Where does it decide how does it decide where to land?
I think in some cases, you know, you can see this when you look at a lightning bolt, right? They're very jagged.
Yeah.
And so they're looking for any path that is the most optimum. And so it can rapidly change as it's trying to move positive or negative charges to an area with that imbalance, so the opposite charge.
It seems instantaneous. It's making that connection.
It's pretty instantaneous.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So it does kind of make that connection instantly.
It does it quickly, yeah.
Yeah.
Like a shock, you know, when we get shocks.
Right, exactly
it's the same thing.
It's an arc of energy. So, but also, is it safe to be in cars or showers during lightning storms? I've heard you shouldn't shower in a lightning storm.
I wouldn't do it. I just
really,
I don't want it. You know, if I can avoid it, it won't last me too long to wait a few minutes. You know, if you get a strike directly on your pipes, they happen to be metal. You got electrified water coming out, so you don't want that.
In your car, I guess, you can electrocute yourself.
You could. I don't think these are things that happen very often.
Right?
But why take the chance? And I think in a car, I think there's so much rubber involved, especially the tires, and you're fairly well grounded. You're okay usually in a car. From the lightning. But the lightning is part of a storm that brings with it a lot of other things, like sometimes a flying cow or a tree.
Isn't
going to save you from that. So it's not an easy answer.
You're always told not to stand under trees during a lightning storm, but I wouldn't think of wood being conductive. And yet, because it's so tall, is that why it connects to the lightning?
This reminds me of a story when I was teaching 100 many years ago. We were talking about lightning in it. One of the students who was a rancher asked me, he goes, can a single bolt of lightning kill 20 cattle? And I was just, in my mind, I'm like, wow. I don't know, where were they? He said, under a tree.
Yeah.
It hits that tree and just travels out through the roots. And it turns out cows are very sensitive to electrical charges.
Is that right?
That's how in slaughterhouses they used to kill them. I don't know what they do now is they just electrically shock them, and then they die pretty quick. Don't go under a tree.
Roast beef.
Because trees are conductive then for...
if they get hit, it's just going to follow down the chains. And
go through the roots, and everything that's above the roots is going to get shocked?
Yep.
Good information to have.
Yes.
Thank you. I guess I always knew not to. I just didn't necessarily understand why. Here to explain it all and more with us today, the weather guys. Steve, John, thank you as always for playing along. Really appreciate it, and certainly learned a thing or two today. Thank you.
It was fun.
Thanks.
Always. Steve Ackerman, former vice chair for research and graduate education at UW-Madison, an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin, professor and former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News.